brought to you by CGTN Europe.
I'm Stephen Cole. Welcome to The Agenda. Earlier this year, the UN released a devastating report outlining how the world failed to meet a single one of the ecological targets set 10 years ago in Aichi, Japan. Next year, world leaders will reconvene in Kunming, China, for the COP15 to set out new goals. In order to find out how these targets would be delivered, I spoke to the person responsible for leading next year's conference, Elizabeth Maruma Marema, the Executive Secretary of the UN's Convention on Biodiversity. I began by asking her whether the Aichi goals were too ambitious.
I think the targets were not too ambitious. There were only 20, with about 60 elements on them. There were other problems why they were not met. And a few examples exist. For many countries, it took 3-4 years before the actual implementation on the ground began, because countries took a step back and began first developing and updating their national action plans and strategies. And therefore, now the decade is coming to an end, but actually, practically, it was half a decade of activities on the ground for its implementation. Another, of course, problem is the engagement of different stakeholders. It was assumed only governments were responsible, while governments put in policies for implementation, while the actual implementation is with other different stakeholders and sectors. And because of that, then, of course, then the government hands were limited, and there was no ownership for many stakeholders to play their role.
Okay, well, you've learned a lesson. Next year, in May, COP15 will be held in Kunming, in China. You will be drawing targets for 2030. But if you haven't achieved the targets for 2020, how can you move on targets for 2030 with any degree of certainty or optimism?
I don't think any countries want to get back into the situation we are today, but really to build back better. One, two, the new framework will align itself to the Sustainable Development Goals. And Sustainable Development Goals are 17. 14 of the goals will depend on the contribution from biodiversity. So we can't avoid, if we'll not meet the next targets, it means also Sustainable Development Goals, which are global targets, will also not be achieved. The Paris Agreement on Climate Change, for which 30% of reduction of greenhouse gas emissions will come from nature-based solutions. Again, that will not be reached. Globally, lessons have been learned. COVID has even made us even more, given us a stark reminder of our relationship, unsustainable relationship to nature.
Right.
I hope we will not repeat the mistakes of the past.
Yes, well, let's hope so, because that would be madness. But are some countries better...
We will all perish.
Exactly. Are some countries, do you think, Elizabeth, better at protecting their biodiversity than others?
You see, each country is unique in its own way, both politically, socially, economically, as well as when it comes to environment and development challenges. And because of that, when it comes to actions on the ground, they also differ from country to country. And equally then, in terms of successes, best practices also differ from country to country.
That sounds a very diplomatic reply, Elizabeth, but it sounds like an apology for the countries who are failing to meet their targets.
It's not an apology, but considering the unique situation of each country. I mean, let's look at developing countries. You can't expect developing countries who are dependent on biodiversity or nature for livelihood, for the jobs, and also, of course, putting pressure on biodiversity. If there are no adequate, appropriate alternatives, if the society is not aware of the dangers and impact and consequences of their actions, obviously, then the status of biodiversity will be different.
That makes sense and possibly explains why some of the goals haven't been met or were too ambitious, which is where we came in on this one. But I want to move on, because in September, leaders from 77 countries signed the Leaders' Pledge for Nature. So how does that differ from the biodiversity targets?
It differs in the sense that we are saying the biodiversity targets have not been met, but the leaders have come up with the political will saying, we need action today, not even tomorrow. Clearly, the leaders have also acknowledged the challenges faced during the past decade that the targets have not been met.
At what point does the damage become irreversible for biodiversity?
The objectives of the convention, and even when we look at our long-term vision, 2050, living in harmony with nature, it means at that time, biodiversity will be restored, conserved, and sustainably used. So where biodiversity has been damaged is basically to be able to restore. But of course, for instance, where certain species have gone to extinction, we can't recover that. And that is an irreversible loss. And we don't want to continue to lose species. And you recall the recent studies, IPBS last year in May, indicating over 1 million species might go into extinction during this century. And if the species go to extinction, we have lost them forever.
Elizabeth, if you don't mind me saying so, you looked and sound to me like a very optimistic person.
We have to.
Do you have optimism? Do you have hope about the ability to come together and save the planet's biodiversity?
Looking at the trend now, I'm optimistic. And why? Clearly now we see particularly different stakeholders coming on board, ready to take action. We have seen also businesses on their own signing their own pledges for action, because studies have also told us $44 trillion are moderately or highly dependent on nature. And if $44 trillion are dependent on nature, and that is $10 trillion per year, it's basically the business, there's a business case here, and the business has an interest to take action if they have to continue to operate. Indigenous peoples and local communities who have been the custodians of biodiversity and nature, the traditional knowledge, and this is where there are lessons for conservation of biodiversity, ready to act and share those best practices. And I have to be optimistic with all this.
With all eyes on the COP15 in Kunming next year, what will be China's role in changing the planet's ecological fate? I spoke to Wu Changhua, the CEO of Beijing's Future Innovation Center, and I asked her why China opted out of the 2020 Leaders' Pledge for Nature alongside Russia, Australia, and the US.
As we all know, China is the COP15 presidency. And so the major goal or mission from the Chinese government is to work very productively, constructively with the United Nations to bring all countries together on board to reach ambitious target for a post-2020 biodiversity conservation framework. And so we all know how complicated or how complex the international process often is, actually. On the other side, I think there is a complexity of the issues we're talking about here. It's about nature. It's about biodiversity. It's not like, you know, we talk about climate change, we're talking about carbon. Nature is everything. So China, actually, as the presidency of COP15, has to be seen as a sort of neutral, right? And has to make sure it's the impartial arbiter of the process. Besides, actually, 2 days after the summit, the biodiversity summit back in September, Chinese President Xi Jinping announced to the world China has committed to achieve carbon neutral before 2060. We all know, actually, the interconnectivity or interlinkage between climate change and biodiversity. The issues themselves. So I know for sure, the commitment on the climate change will provide another major boost to the endeavor around biodiversity conservation in the coming decades.
So you hope to bring everybody together next year in Kunming. That's a commendable ambition. But what do you hope to achieve?
Well, at this moment, I think, you know, there are a few words on the table in terms of the level of ambition. One is ambitious. Second word is balanced. And the third word is realistic, right? And so when we're looking into...
Can we add another word? Can we add goals? Because they haven't been achieved as yet.
That's true. I think around the goals, actually, this is a part of the goal. So whatever, how you describe the goal, I think those three words actually today on the table to make sure it's ambitious enough, and particularly learning from the previous decade, the decade just passing by, and so that we have to continue to be ambitious there. Balance, in a way, as I said, it's a complexity issue itself, right? We had to figure out actually the goals on one side we set, and the other side we had to make sure it's implementable.
Perhaps the goals or the targets last time round were too ambitious, and there was a lack of awareness or possibly a lack of will. So will that change in Kunming?
I think that's what everyone is hoping for. That's why this process between now and the leading to Kunming, the COP, actually becomes so critical. The whole complexity of system actually together. We had to make sure we get all the pieces together. So yes, we are partly learning from the lessons from the previous decade, right? If you look at the Aichi, the target there, out of the 20, pretty much, you know, the conclusion was that we didn't really complete none of them, basically, right? And even though partially, you know, we've been delivering here and there, you know, around the progress and so, but so far, there were two major things we learned. One, actually, there is accelerated sort of biodiversity losses. Secondly, the pressures on biodiversity losses continue to be intensified, right? So generally speaking, we have sort of failed in a way in terms of biodiversity conservation.
So does that make the biodiversity conversation in China far more urgent?
It's already urgent. And if you look at China's endeavor at this moment, I think compared to many other countries, China feels more urgent, actually, than many others in a way. One, actually, the continued economic growth are pretty much constrained by environmental pollution, by climate change, and also by resource scarcity there, right? So on the other side, if you look at the endeavor the government has been developing, there were three things around that would cause ecological civilization. One is ecological redlining. Because we know the urgency, we know the footprints actually have already exceeded the nature's carrying capacity. That's why the government is stepping up effort and say we need to define them. You know, we need a red line, literally, the ecological footprints. Secondly, we do need to price natural capital, right? So we need to have a strong economic signal actually to the economic system and say there is a price you have to pay. And lastly, of course, there's ecological compensation. We have to address the equity issues there as well.
Okay.
So in a nutshell, China definitely has demonstrated its efforts to reflect the sense of urgency it has already felt. And of course, domestically now with the presidency of COP15, so China wants to work globally with everyone else actually to advance the global agenda.
Wu Changhua, CEO of Beijing's Future Innovation Center. Many thanks for joining us on The Agenda. One of the most effective ways of tackling the biodiversity crisis is by planting trees, which absorb CO2 in the atmosphere. Last year, one Swiss laboratory published a report revealing that there are 1.7 billion hectares of unused land where over a trillion new trees could have space to grow. I asked the founder of that laboratory, Dr. Thomas Crowther, why that land isn't already being used for reforestation.
That's a very good question. So first, I should clarify that when we talk about forests, we're not just talking about full, completely trees everywhere. That can be just 10% of tree cover in an area. So it could be just one tree in a field. When you actually aggregate all of those areas down, it goes to about 0.9 billion hectares, which is effectively the size of the United States. And the reason that that land is available for restoration is because of past degradation, past land use or agriculture, and then that agriculture has moved on, leaving the land sort of depleted of its nutrients so that trees don't necessarily automatically recover.
Tell me why you think reforestation is the best way, the most effective strategy of mitigating climate change.
So firstly, there's a huge potential for carbon drawdown, as large, if not larger, than any other carbon drawdown solution available to us. And it's a low-tech solution. So it just means the engagement of people all around the world, managing their ecosystems, restoring ecosystems, and bringing back biodiversity to the region can have this huge and considerable impact on carbon storage.
So we were talking there mainly about mitigating the effects of climate change. Does that apply equally to biodiversity?
Absolutely. I would argue that the revitalization of biodiversity is, in fact, the primary goal for our research. I think once we bring back biodiversity to our planet, then is when we start to see stability in the climate. And there's a long history of evidence pointing towards that. The more biodiverse and rich our ecosystems are, the healthier and more stable our climate can become.
Many tree planting projects invariably involve the planting of one type of tree. Does that harm or does that help biodiversity?
So, yes, these monocultures, as we call them, places where you plant just one type of tree, can actually be really devastating to ecosystems. That is not the revitalization of nature. Now, in some places, it's useful for timber, and for local communities, planting those trees in monocultures can be useful for providing livelihoods. But in that sense, they function effectively like a farm. However, if we're talking about revitalizing Earth's forests, it's the biodiversity that we desperately need. We cannot be washing away all of that biodiversity and leaving just a monoculture of one tree. We need many species, native species, that bring back the birds, the bees, the insects that we all need to survive.
You're the chief scientific advisor to the UN's Trillion Tree Campaign. How are you going to achieve that from a practical point of view?
In the vast majority of cases, what we need to be doing is protecting areas that are previously degraded and allowing those trees to recover. That is the most sustainable. It brings back biodiversity in a healthy way. It brings back healthy ecosystems. And it's something that we can do passively. But what we need to work on is figuring out how to engage local communities around the world so that they can do that and so that they can benefit from the economic benefits that those rejuvenating ecosystems can provide, like protection from degradation and harsh conditions, like clean air and water, like food and medicines, and bringing back fertility that can also help your local agriculture. So that is the real challenge of the global restoration movement.
Are you optimistic we can do that?
I am. Being optimistic, I think, is the key to the whole challenge. Everyone, there's a real risk in the climate change movement that pessimism will dominate and therefore prevent us from doing anything. When you feel down and stressed about the depressing climate change situation, it can often lead to inaction. Optimism and the impacts that I'm seeing with local landowners all over the world is the thing that drives action. You see, every little action inspires more action. And the more people engage, the more they see the sustainable benefits, and the more valuable this impact, this movement becomes. Even if we didn't achieve a trillion trees, every single step in the right direction is valuable for Earth's biodiversity and for climate change.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of The Agenda. Remember, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can also find us on CGTN Europe Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
The most interesting questions.
Are there other living beings beyond Earth?
Will man or machine be in charge?
Great question.
Always have more than one answer.
Well, hold on, let me just draw up a list.
And always come from more than one person.
That's where the credibility lies.
The concept of having a machinery which is alive and evolving didn't wait for us.
The end of inequality of incomes and wealth around the world, can you imagine how difficult that is at the moment to achieve?
Every episode, Stephen Cole, Murray Beveridge, and some of the brightest minds out there shed light on the answers to some of the most intriguing questions.
There are two ways of looking at this.
Machines can't really discriminate between civilian and military targets.
The Answers Project.
Maybe we need to just look at this in a bit more detail.
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
The Answers Project, a new podcast from CGTN Europe.